Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparutade sangamatasa tawara e sodavanta bamunjantu satang. This afternoon we have this opportunity to reflect on Dhamma the way it is. And I thought I'd reflect on emotions that we have as human beings, because we have a way of saying, don't be emotional, be rational, be sensible. Oftentimes we're afraid of our emotions, or we want to get rid of them, or we don't like to make scenes or be emotional in public, or hide what we feel, because we identify with emotion as a very personal way. But when you really reflect on the way it is being a human being, it's an emotional experience. It's about feeling. And as I've pointed out many times, the sense realm that we're experiencing through the bodies we have, you know, so emotions arise and cease according to conditions. One is, you know, when we think of somebody as an emotional person, that can be a criticism. We can think they're difficult because they're always being emotional about everything. Where we praise those who are very rational and reasonable, sensible, unemotional. So these are the values of Western society that we're all a part of or experiencing, whether you were born in the Western world or not. So contemplating that this is an emotional experience, just being a man or a woman is basically about feeling. We have to feel life with these, through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And feeling can be, there's pleasant, neutral, and unpleasant feeling. So these are categories that we can, general categories we use to describe feeling, whether it's physical feeling of pleasure, pain, or emotional feeling of hope or happiness or despair. So when we reflect on emotion, begin to take the personal attachment to it, whether it's you take it personally or you're trying to hide it or not be emotional, you're trying to be sensible, reasonable, not let emotions interfere in relationships. Be aware of that, of how we are so caught up in our own personal identities with right and wrong, true and false, good and bad, that we aren't aware of the way it is for whether you're male or female, monk, nun, layperson, whatever race, nationality, we all share this experience of being, feeling isolated in a physical form. Because that's how it appears. When we identify with the body, then we're kind of putting ourselves into a very unstable form, which separates us from Dhamma, from the way it is, from ultimate reality. So one of the emotions that humans have is jealousy. And this is kind of, you know, to say someone is jealous or to claim to be a jealous person. These are, you know, conditions that we can be criticized for. The feeling of being jealous is an unpleasant one, unwanted. I don't think anybody wants to be jealous, but this emotion arises when the conditions for that particular emotion are present. They come and go and change. The conditions change. The reaction to the conditions changes. And I remember suffering from jealousy years ago, and in Thailand, I was very much ashamed of it. So I wanted to get rid of it. So it was a problem I didn't like myself, didn't like the feeling. I was embarrassed by it. I pretended I was never jealous. But yet, as I meditated more, I became aware that this is a feeling I don't like and don't want. And so I went to a monk and asked how to deal with it. And they said, well, spread mudita, or sympathetic joy. The Brahmavihara, third Brahmavihara, is a way of conquering jealousy. So I followed the instructions and tried to feel sympathetic joy for when I experienced this emotion. And sometimes I could actually feel mudita, but a lot of the time it was like play acting. I was trying to smother it, destroy it with this very positive, admirable state of mudita. So then, meditating further on the feeling, I began to investigating the desires, the desire to get rid of it was the real problem. Vipavadanha, the second noble truth, the third kind of desire to get rid of what you don't like. So just beginning to recognize that jealousy wasn't really a problem, it was the suffering was around vipavadanha, desire to get rid of it. Seeing it in a very personal way, seeing it as something wrong with me, something I'm ashamed of, don't want, don't like. And when we think like that, what is that? That's desire to get rid of something you don't like. Same with fear. Fear is, when the conditions arise, we feel fear. In my generation of Americans, we were, the ideal for manhood was to be fearless and brave. You know, I'm not afraid of anything. I'm tough. And this was the role model for, especially for my generation of American men. And so one tried to conquer fear In the same way, one didn't want it. One didn't want people to see other men, especially see me frightened by things that other people were not frightened of. But the desire to get rid of fear was the real problem, not fear, not jealousy, but desire to get rid of it. Because this is a realm of jealousy, survival, fear. It's about feeling, about experiencing emotions about that arise when the conditions are there to bring this particular emotion into consciousness. So it's like investigating this in terms of wisdom. You begin, rather than seeing, having idolized how a good monk should be or a good nun, how they one should be if one was really a proper bhikkhu or a siladhara, you know, you can idolize. You hold models up like Lungpa Cha, Lungpu Man, you know, who are legends now. And legends don't feel anything. So they're like ideals of monastic form and behavior. And then we compare the living realities we experience in daily life with the ideals that we hold about how to what a good monk, good nun should be, or a good lay person, or a good mother, or a good father, or they're all, you know, based on kind of ideal, taking something to a ideal state that you can imagine. You can imagine ideals, but that's all they are. They're wisps, will-o'-the-wisp. They get blown away easily. Ideals are guiding lights, but they're not to be grasped. So role models, like Lungpa Cha as a role model, gives us hope and inspiration. But then most of you never met him, so you don't know the living reality of Lungpa Cha. And we don't know his history of what he had to go through to be an enlightened master. Because we all, whether it's Lungpu Man, Lungpu Cha, or whoever, we have to experience this form of a human form that is subject to all kinds of conditions we have little or no control over. So in reflecting on this, this is where the Four Noble Truths are so important, is because the Second Noble Truth is a way of beginning to have the insight into letting go of these conditions that we identify with, that we hold to. Some might be very good. It's not to get rid of conditions. You know, it's not like committing suicide or destroying your ego or anything like that, but you begin to see you're not what you think. You're not an ego. You're not an emotion. You're not a human form. And that's liberation, because as long as you believe that your true nature is a human form, then it's always this, it's subject to so many conditions, like growing old, like COVID pandemic, things that are beyond our control. And our ideals oftentimes are formed when we're young, and we compare ourselves to ideals that are perfect, but the realities we experience through the forms that we identify with are imperfect, unstable, unsatisfactory. Whose body, no matter what your age is perfect and stable and perfectly satisfying? You know, you'll never, only a very foolish person would think that they're perfect. A narcissist. That's the modern word for a foolish person that thinks they're perfect. Once you begin to take refuge in Dhamma, or the way it is, then you can deal with the karma of your life, the way you are, as what you inherit through your parents, through your ancestry, through the experiences of your life, of childhood and teenage and onward to old age. These are no longer seen in personal ways of judgment, but beginning to realize it's like this. So like jealousy, if you feel that emotion, use it, be aware of it. It is present, you're feeling it. There's a feeling of envy or jealousy, and it's like this. So you, in this way of looking at jealousy, you begin to let go of it. You don't try to wipe it out or destroy it or become someone who's conquered jealousy, but it's part of the human experience that we learn from through wisdom. So this we call mindfulness or awareness, conscious awareness. And through this continuous investigation of experience of life, as you experience here at Amaravati, whatever way you experience this monastery, whether you're an ordained member or not, you having the experience of being in a Buddhist monastery, which you might idolize. So it's easy for ordained members of Sangha as well as lay people to be critical of monasteries, because maybe Amaravati doesn't really fit into your ideal Buddhist monastery. Because one can form an ideal. I had many ideals. I was a very idealistic youth. And so I would... Nong Bapong, when I first went there, I formed an ideal about it, that this was the perfect monastery. And then I judge other monasteries by my ideal, how I regarded Wat Pa Nong Bapong at that time, the first year. So when I'd visit other monasteries, my critical faculties would be very sharp. This teacher is not as good as mine, or their Vinaya is not as strict as ours, and on like that, the critical mind forms an ideal that one gets very attached to. and judges other conditions by. Well, being, you know, a critic of life is a lot of suffering because the negative side is so, there's so much to criticize about being the human that you identify with, about your life, about your parents, about your culture, about your age, your gender. So you can, you know, there's so many things wrong, not right about samsara or the world that we experience, that we tend to worry and suffer from it. Then we can see at this time just the warlike nature of humanity. Is it natural to be warlike? Is it, you know, having these wars in Israel and Gaza, in Ukraine, Russia, Sudan, endless wars and famine and starvation and murder and slaughter and rape. And these are like news on the media. You listen to World Service in the morning and it's all about how horrible what's going on a planet where we have such things as United Nations, such good attempts to bring democracy and preserve democracy, human rights, equality. We've got the ideals in mind. You know, how things should be. But the way it is like this, and we, instead of comparing the present, your ideal with the realities that you're witnessing, you begin to see that this realm is basically about survival and procreation, sex and violence, and jealousy, envy, part of, you know, wanting what others have, trying to control, become a powerful person or a powerful nation, a superpower. That's the ultimate ideal, to be the world superpower. So the wars are fought over ideals, about feelings of fear and jealousy, resentment, seeking revenge against people who've done you wrong. Now we can, you know, ideally we shouldn't be cruel and jealous, and we should be fearless, brave. We should respect life, share the planet, work together for the welfare of the world's population is a magnificent ideal. But is that really possible as long as we're identified with these forms that are not ideal? Living life, you know, just being brought up in a family, having an older brother, sister, one can be jealous of or envious or resentful just about the family you live in, because this is part of human experience. Is it personal? Is it, you know, we should love our parents is the ideal. We should respect and love our parents because they gave us birth, and we should be thankful for that. That's the ideal. But how you actually feel is like this. If you're ungrateful, then it's ungratefulness is like this. And your relationship to what you're feeling is through witnessing, through being the witness to the way it is rather than the judge. So the idea of having mudita is, you know, that comes naturally once you learn to let go. Just intellectually, it's an ideal. The Brahma-viharas tend to be, for most of people, are ideals, beautiful ideas. Loving kindness, metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. Upeka is equanimity. And then when we try to get upeka, try to make yourself equanimous as a personal act. Try to live your life as a Buddhist samana with upeka as your experience of life. That's an ideal. But these four Brahma-viharas are quite natural when you have the insight into letting go of conditioned phenomena, not trying to get rid of it, change it, or judge it. But recognizing all conditions are impermanent. That's their nature. They're not ideal. They're not fixed in time. What is perfect is what you already are, but you don't know it because you identify with what you're not. This is called avicca, or ignorance of Dhamma, not knowing ultimate reality, and being caught in a web of experiences that you may not have ever asked for, but we without intention, we get caught up in the web of society, of family life, of monastic life, of modern politics, modern religions. We get caught in a web, a sticky web that we can't really get out of through willfulness, just through trying to get rid of the web and free ourselves, because whatever we do, we stick to the web no matter how much we resist it and fight it. So then wisdom, panya or wisdom, is available to us. We're not just helpless victims of a system we don't really understand. Who created all this? Who created you as a personality? What, you know, who created the sun, moon, and stars? How old is the planet Earth? How long have human beings existed on the planet? Why? What was like when there were dinosaurs, when it was reptilian life, or before that? Because they're conscious forms in time and space, just like we are. But their basic function was survival and procreation. And nature itself, as the animal nature, it's all about survival and procreation. This is a form that we identify with, the sexual drive is natural drive to procreate the species. You didn't seek it or seek it out or make a choice. You're born with this energy as a sexual form or survival. The desire to survive and procreate is part of the condition of all animals. And so we reflect on that, because can you, like the cats that live in the monastery, they live in a Buddhist monastery where we keep moral precepts and are nonviolent, and yet try to give a cat the five precepts about not killing, it doesn't work, because their very nature is to survive and eat and survive and procreate. This is samsara, is like this. It's about fear and desire. And the way to, and the human condition, so we have Buddhas. And so what is a Buddha? You know, the historical sage of ancient India, or is it an icon such as the one behind me? But the word Buddha actually means awakened, aware of the way it is. So when the Buddha was enlightened, according to the scriptures, what did he witness? And according to the traditional views, you know, sitting under the Bodhi tree, he experienced all the desirable temptations of beautiful forms and all the frightening, terrifying ones, all that's delightful and seductive and pleasant, and all the horrifying, scary conditions attacked the ascetic Gautama, as you're under the tree. What does that really mean? It means that this is part of human nature to have these experiences of temptation, of attraction, of fear and aversion, to be jealous and frightened, to worry, to be anxious. This is part of what we create in our minds through identifying with what we're not. What are we then? What did the Buddha realize at that time when he realized he was enlightened? He realized his true nature is conscious awareness. Because all these forms, the beautiful ones, the frightening ones, arise and cease, come and go and change according to conditions. But through all that, then as the story goes, the Buddha restrained himself from trying to control or resist, but to acknowledge all conditions are impermanent. All Dhamma is self, is not self. So my encouragement is not to be aware of the way you are, the habits you have, good or bad habits. Like in this particular tradition, conforming to behavioral precepts is is a prerequisite. So we do what is good and refrain from doing what isn't or what's wholesome. But then we can identify with the precepts. Worry about the precepts. We can create problems around the Vinaya precepts because we still see them in very personal ways of I'm right or wrong, skillful or unskillful. Now the precepts is like an honor system. So we can restrain ourselves in terms of action and speech. We might want to hit somebody, but we don't because it's against the precepts. But then how do you feel when you feel you get so angry at somebody you want to hit them? Are you a good monk or a bad monk? You know, you can think that a good monk would not even have that kind of emotion. And so then we feel guilty. Guilt is a problem with many of us, feeling guilty. And identifying with of what's right and wrong, good or bad, rather than being able to wisely reflect on the way it is and respond to contingencies as we experience them. You can't help the way you feel, but you have some restraint and control over action and speech. So that's morality, being able to be responsible for what you say and what you do with your body. So this is a celibate community, so we refrain from acting on sexual desires, but we can't get rid of them. But we can be aware that this is part of the human condition. It's natural, impersonal, and it's impermanent and not self. Apply that to anger. It's a survival mechanism. Anger is a way to survive in survival of the fittest, the jungle. It's a way of protecting the family, of protecting oneself. There's a lot to be angry about in samsara. Because samsara is like this. It is imperfect, unstable. And then we imagine it should be perfect and stable, but it's not. It's never going to be perfect and stable. What is perfect and stable is conscious awareness. You begin to realize this for yourself. It's to be realized, each one of us, for ourselves. And this is what we're here for, why we take the ordination precepts. Because it gives us a form that we didn't design, like the Vinaya. None of us particularly chose the precepts. So it's not that, you know, it's a traditional form about action and speech. So then that gives us a form to reflect from. Like Dhamma is formless. There's no form to it. And we have to live with the form of a human body for a lifetime. And so the Buddha established the Vinaya to establish a traditional form for action and speech that isn't particularly what we have designed. It's designed as part of an ancient tradition, we assume, established by the Buddha himself. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's the what we assume. So the form itself is something to use mindfully, not to be identified with. Because we're just exchanging one form for another form is not a way of liberation. But using form to restrain oneself from lying, from using language that's harmful, insulting, from stealing, from promiscuous sexual behavior, from killing others, on and like that. The form is about nonviolence. So it's a beautiful form in itself. But it's to be used, not to be clung to. So the realization of Dhamma can only happen when you let go of everything. All forms, all conditions, all identities. Then you begin to realize the perfection of consciousness, what is magical, what is perfect. When we think of magic, we think of tricks, you know, that magicians can play, something special that isn't rational, reasonable, or can be defined in any way. So what is magical, really? This is how I realize it, is conscious awareness. Because Ajahn Sumedho didn't create it. It's here and now. It's realizable. It's not something that I've developed or cultivated. Even in my most deluded states, it's always consciousness. But one gets so involved with one's delusions that you forget, you don't realize that. You try to deal with the deluded emotional problems of life as a separate person, and oftentimes it gets more complicated and difficult as you try to solve problems through personal efforts. But through awareness, then the problems of life, whatever your character might be, is part of the path of realization that all conditions are impermanent. And yet you're really not a separate person. And that is ultimate freedom, because being a separate person is scary. Being caught in the web of delusion of my separateness. Brings up old habits of self-consciousness and fear, jealousy, desire. So if I take refuge in just my personal habits, then life is a very frightening experience. You know, when you think about what happens when somebody dies, where do they go? You know, so we have all kinds of ways of dealing with that. Like, you know, and we think of reincarnation or rebirth, personal rebirth. Does a person ever get reborn? Or does personality arise and cease according to conditions? When the body dies, the personality is, the conditions for that personality aren't present. So is death oblivion? It's another word we can use for what happens when somebody dies. It's just, that's it, that's the end. But that's also a created perception. Is it the end? Or what has no end? And that's conscious awareness. No beginning or end. No features, it's here and now, and what we're all experiencing this very moment. So you can, these are words, they're meant to encourage you to realize this for yourself. In a sangha, you know, living with community of males and females, different generations, different nationalities, races, and so forth. We tend to make judgments from our own way of we've been conditioned. So it's, you know, we tend to judge each other. We tend to see each other as emotional or rational or reasonable or wise or stupid or troublesome or helpful. We've got all kinds of words, both positive and negative, to describe each other. But these are words. Words are impermanent. They're sankharas. That's where even consciousness is a word. Conscious awareness are two words. But this is what we are here and now, all of us, conscious. And without any words to describe it, we begin to see words as kind of pointers and empty phenomena, rather than words that we grasp, like ideal words or views and opinions we might experience or hold to. So Buddha is a word, Dhamma is a word. So do we take refuge in Dhamma as a word? Or what is a refuge? Is awareness here and now. And that's the end of suffering. It doesn't mean that you as a person escape old age, sickness, and death. It means that you no longer hold your identity to the limitations of the form, the body, the habits that we tend to identify with. So I offer this as a reflection.